Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of A Second Helping of Hannibal. We're going to be talking about entree today. I'm Matt Unger.
I'm Beth Unger.
And as usual, we're going to have this discussion in two parts. The first part, we've just watched it, and we're going to give our instant reaction and a recap. And then we're going to take a break, watch it again, and see if anything else comes up when we discuss it a second time. As always, this is a very spoiler-heavy show. There's going to be spoilers for the individual episode, and there's going to be spoilers for the whole series here. So just keep that in mind. If you haven't watched the series all the way through, you might want to consider coming back to this after you've done that. And really, why wouldn't you? As quickly as possible.
Okay, so I'm going to start this recap. I'm going to try and keep it short if I can. I'm just going to say by way of introduction that first of all, in this episode, we're going to meet several characters who are going to be with us for some time. And also that the references to Silence of the Lambs are
legion,
frequent and unapologetic.
Yes, which is a thing I really want to discuss. And I really think I'm going to spend the entire discussion talking about why that is and why would that be a choice in this episode. But go on.
Okay. And I have a lot I want to discuss about people's motivations for what they're doing in this episode and also for Hannibal's therapy, among other things.
Also, in listening to previous recordings, I was going crazy listening to how many times I used the word episode in each recording. So I'm going to try really hard not to just be like episode, episode, episode over and over again. So that's my goal for today.
Okay, so here goes. We meet Dr. Abel Gideon, played by Eddie Izzard. I love him. Dr. Gideon is ill-advisedly removed from his cell. He gets out of his cuffs and murders a nurse. And this is the first callback to Silence of the Lambs. It is very reminiscent of Lecter in the cage, getting out of his cuffs and killing the
security guards.
The guards. Yeah. This murder is gruesome. We don't see it right away. We'll see it when Will reenacts it, but we do see the beginning of it where he's punching the nurse, and it's like very brutal. I mean, it gets more gruesome, but it's brutal right from the start.
Right. And I just want to bookmark that because that's part of, I think, something I want to talk about as to why this episode refers to Silence of the Lambs so much. So anyway,
okay,
let's keep going.
So Will and Jack arrive at the Baltimore State Hospital for the criminally insane, which looks, and the name of which and the look of which seems like very 19th century and very horror movie. And they're going there because the murder committed by Dr. Gideon was done in the style of an unapprehended serial killer known as the Chesapeake Bay Ripper. Jack and Will have a conversation before they enter the facility, which we need to come back to later because there's a lot of foreshadowing in that conversation. We then meet Dr. Chilton, Dr. Frederick Chilton.
So good.
Also an important character in Silence of the Lambs. He is incredibly odious. And I think we can talk about why later and some of the conversations that go on between Chilton and other people at this time and at later times. Will visits the crime and Chilton believes that, or says he believes that Dr. Gideon is the Ripper. And again, I think the motives driving him are something we'll discuss. Will goes to the crime scene, goes into his fugue state. This is a very, very brutal murder where he pokes her eyes out with his thumbs. You see these empty sockets. She is then still crawling on the ground for her life. And he, in this very, very sort of casual way, removes the top part of one of those poles that you hang your intravenous bags on and begins what will be poking her with many, many, many stick-like items. And when Will comes...
It's called a bag pull in the middle.
Oh.
No, it's not. But that would be a good name. Bag pull. Nurse, I need a bag pull.
Stat. Okay. Will comes out of the fugue state. He's quite tearful. He seems very shaken by the level of brutality in this murder. Jack has a flashback to his first meeting with Miriam Lass. The flashbacks are in black and white. I think they're sort of beautiful. This is another very Silence of the Lambs situation. Jack is bringing in an FBI trainee to use for particular purposes that aren't apparent to us yet to track down a serial killer. And it's very reminiscent of Jack and Clarice Starling.
Yep.
Alana,
I mean, she even physically resembles Clarice Starling.
100%. 100%.
And has her sort of like all business demeanor also.
And I guess we should say she is played by Anna, I guess her name is Chlumsky.
Yeah.
She's a very big character in the show Veep, which I don't think you've ever watched.
No, I'm not a Veep person.
She's very good in Veep. So there's a conversation with Alana and Will and Chilton. We can talk more about that later, but Chilton is rude to Alana. The conversation involves essentially Will and Alana discussing why they don't think Dr. Gideon is the Ripper, or why his scene isn't really what the Ripper did. It doesn't match what the Ripper did, and that includes doing a lot of the desecration of the body after death, whereas the Ripper did it while the victims were alive, and also about the removal of organs. So there's differences. Then we have a scene where we sort of are cutting back and forth, but without really cutting, of Will and Alana conducting separate interviews with Dr. Gideon and questioning.
And it's really well put together. Like, yes. There. It seems like it's just one conversation with three people. It's really, really good.
I assume it was filmed with the both of them in the room, but I think they were both there and actually having the one conversation, because it doesn't look like there's cutting actually going on to me. But we can talk about that later. They are questioning him about whether he is really the Ripper. And this is, again, we have a very Silence of the Lamb-ish scene with Alana walking past the cells of the other psychiatric inmates and then sitting down in the little metal chair, and Gideon is in a jumpsuit, so it's all very Silence of the Lambs.
It's shot for shot. It's really, like, there's no, it's so deliberate, and so it's meant to get your attention, I think, if you've even seen the movie once, right?
Yes. Will, at the end of this interview, suggests that someone is convincing Dr. Gideon to believe or claim that he's the Ripper. Jack shows up at Hannibal's house. He's very upset about his wife. He's talking about his grief. Hannibal sort of pushes him along in a therapeutic way that I'd like to discuss later, to connect this to Miriam Lass. Like, he asks, who else couldn't you save? Mm-hmm. And we get this flashback to Miriam Lass, of Miriam Lass profiling one of the Ripper's victims. Jack asks her the question, what do you see? If I'm not mistaken, that's also from Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And
she nails it. She nails it almost. Like, almost. She gets as much as you can imagine her getting. Like,
yes.
They have a very important conversation about whether it's a true psychopath. And also that she characterizes Lecter, or the killer, as exotic,
like, because Jack non-white. Is asking if he's white, and she's like, maybe not, he's exotic. There's a lot that goes on in that conversation, and maybe we should come back to it. You know, she's right about a lot of things and not right about a lot of other things, like why he's taking the trophies. She's missing that one.
But you don't expect her to be complete. I mean, she's not a superhero, right?
Correct.
Like, but
correct.
She's on the right track.
He's not Hannibal Lecter. She's not Hannibal Lecter.
right.
But she's not Will, but she's quite intuitive. And there's a comparison made between her and Will later, which I think is interesting. We have a conversation with the forensic team where there's some discussion going on about whether this nurse victim is a victim of the Ripper. Will thinks it's a plagiarist, and that if it is a plagiarist, the actual Ripper is going to be mad about it and will want to let everyone know that this is the work of a plagiarist. Jack then gets the call of Miriam Lass's voice recording saying she doesn't know where she is and she was so, so wrong. That's he gets that while he's in bed at home alone. Bella's at a NATO conference. He reports this to the forensic team, who question whether Jack really heard her and suggest that he was possibly asleep. Jack makes a statement, "I know when I'm awake," and yeah. We cut to Will, who clearly doesn't know when he's awake and is seeing the Raven Stag come in. Alana and Jack come to Will with a proposition that they use Freddie Lowndes to publicize that Gideon is the Ripper, to get the Ripper to expose himself. Will is not a fan of this plan because he is very much afraid that this will prompt the actual Ripper to kill again. But they do go forward and do this. They have a conversation with Freddie Lowndes. The issue of the most popular professions of psychopaths comes up, and they talk about surgeons, journalists, and law enforcement. Freddie is also wearing several insane outfits during the course of the episode. Sorry, I said episode.
No, you're allowed to. I just am not.
So, as I said, Will has suggested that this is going to really infuriate the true Ripper if his work is being plagiarized. We cut to hearing Freddie reading, you know, her voice reading the published article, and we see Hannibal reading it on his tablet. And in fact, he does appear to be furious, as indicated by him twitching a finger. And he's just twitching a finger, and he has something in his eye, and he's irate.
Yeah. And this is the first time we've seen something really get his goat or take him by surprise.
He is not pleased. Again, Jack goes to see Dr. Gideon again. Dr. Gideon claims to have killed Miriam Lass. Then Jack gets a call that on his cell phone while he's talking to Gideon, and it says home. So he assumes it's Bella, but it's not. It's a call from his house with the recorded voice of Miriam Lass. I will say that when the forensic team comes over to investigate the scene of Jack's house, what Jack says is
what Michael Corleone says.
In my bedroom where my wife sleeps. He does not say, "Where my children come and play with their toys."
No.
Why did they reference Godfather 2?
There's something going on with this episode where they're just having a lot of fun with references.
And I mean, I was just delighted when I heard that line again, because I think you also recently rewatched The Godfather 2. And that line is...
And have also seen it 400,000 times. Yeah, like, but there's also no way to hear that line.
And that line is such a standout because it's really the Pacino yelling and getting quiet line delivery. In my house, in my bedroom, where my wife sleeps. When my children come and play with their toys.
which was early on, like, that hadn't been the way he delivered every single line in his life at that point. So
on the cusp.
He's getting there.
Okay. So that was a treat. Miriam Lass's fingerprints and hair are at the scene. Will says that the caller knows that Jack felt close to Miriam Lass and feels responsible for her death, which leads us into a flashback in which we see Jack encouraging Miriam Lass to break the law by violating confidentiality and investigating the medical records of the victims to find out who their doctors were, and to follow up because the Ripper is believed to be a doctor. So he's really manipulating her into doing this. We get a cut with a voiceover that starts before we actually visually cut of Alana telling Dr. Gideon, "You might have been manipulated into believing you're the Ripper." So we're really being highlighted about manipulation. Gideon points out that her telling him that is manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have dinner at Hannibal's house, and it is a dinner between Alana Hannibal and Dr. Chilton. There is a lot to talk about at this dinner, including what is served at this dinner. I really need to come back to that. But we get two things that are very important. One is the Silence of the Lambs reference to having an old friend for dinner.
Yes, and the chatty lamb.
That's lamb.
Yep.
And we have our first conversation, our first actual conversation about psychic driving and the manipulation of patients. And again, this is where I sort of want to talk both about Hannibal's form of therapy and also what is driving people to do what they're doing in this episode. We do see Hannibal kind of do his trick of making it appear to Dr. Chilton, to Chilton, that he is allying himself with Chilton against Alana by saying, like, basically, I would have done psychic driving if I were you, and sort of giving Chilton permission to acknowledge that he psychically drove Gideon into believing that he is the Ripper. But there's a lot that goes on in that conversation that I'd like to come back to. Jack gets another call. This call, a recorded call of Miriam. This call leads them into a location where they find Miriam's with the phone and a card reading, "What do you see?" which are the words Jack used to her. And of course, Will's always being asked, "What does he see? What does he see?" Jack and Hannibal have a conversation in which Hannibal asks the name of the trainee who Jack lost, as if he doesn't know. And we get this flashback, which is, I have so much to talk about, but what we see here is Miriam is investigating. I want to just go back for 1 second and say that when they're going to discovering Miriam's arm, Beverly makes a comment about how they couldn't find where she was because Miriam had made some kind of mental leap in her thinking about tracking down the Ripper, and she compares Miriam last to Will. You know, she made a leap like you do. In any event, the flashback is Miriam last coming in to talk to Hannibal because she realized Hannibal was the attending in the ER the night this victim was brought in. Hannibal says he doesn't really remember, but then offers to get journals that he kept at the time. She starts wandering around while he goes up the stairs or up the ladder to get the journals. We see her then see the sketch of a Ripper victim, and we have these two shots of Hannibal coming up behind her that are phenomenal. Like, one is
him coming down those stairs like a cat.
And then coming, everything's like a cat because he's got his shoes off and he's in his stocking feet. And it felt very cat-like to me. There's a shot of her seeing the picture and him coming up behind her in like this very fast way, like a jungle cat.
Yeah.
And then there's a shot from behind him just of his feet in his socks coming silently behind her. Now,
I love this setup to it, too, because when he goes up the ladder, he's wearing his shoes, and the sound design, you really hear, like, clop, 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 like you really hear his feet clomping up the stairs, and you almost wonder, was he doing it to, like, you know, remind her that
he's up there, and she's going to hear him when he comes up down. There,
right, and then he just silently just slips down those stairs.
And he appears to kill her. It's very interesting. It's the first time we've seen him ostensibly killing somebody, although later, of course, it'll be revealed that she's not actually dead. But it happens in this... She is not someone he's killing because she's vulgar or rude or distasteful to him. He's actually killing her out of necessity because she's on his trail.
Yep.
He kills her in a way, or appears to kill her in a way that is both very violent and extremely tender.
I think there's a couple of things about it. Well, do you want to finish the synopsis?
That's sort of the end of the synopsis. We can talk about the nature of that apparent killing because it's very striking in a lot of ways. Yeah. But that's where the episode ends. And now we can talk about whatever else you want to talk about.
Well, I think that killing is a good place to work backwards from for the episode, because he kills her in a way that's, yes, very tender. And in fact, I think he even puts his hand on her neck the same way he puts his hand on Abigail Hobbs's neck when he's preventing her from bleeding. And he kind of kisses the top of her head.
For sure.
And he sort of doesn't want to be doing this. And I think the relationship between her and Clarice Starling kind of makes us feel that a little bit more. If you're a Silence of the Lambs fan, you're going to remember that he really liked Clarice. And you could see when he makes the decision to kill her at the desk, you see it dawn on his face.
Yes.
And he just says, "Too bad, I've got to do this now." And he goes up the stairs and he comes down and kills her. But he really, you almost think he doesn't want to. And it's a very he tries to minimize her fear. He tries to make sure it's quick. And there is, I think, a callback to the way he's holding her and the way that he holds Abigail Hobbs when he's preventing her neck from bleeding in the first episode. And also, it's in stark contrast to the brutality of the initial killing that we see.
Yes. There's something... Well, here's the thing. I agree with you. He decides he has to kill her. He does it at the desk. And then he offers to get his journals, right? Like, he's decided to kill her before she sees the sketch, which is, I think, why he allows her to see the sketch. I think in a strange way. I mean, because he could have just gotten her out of there. But I think he sees that she is smart enough that she could catch him.
Yeah.
And he both respects that and is attracted to a brain that could come that close, but also understands the necessity of removing her as a very real threat to him. So yes, I think there is not a reluctance to kill her, but a different tone to this very violent death, that there does seem to be some very weird paradoxical tenderness to it. There's also just even in doing it, there does seem to be some level of kind of ecstasy on his face in the act of doing what he's doing that almost looks orgasmic. Like he almost has a face at the end like he's orgasming.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. Like it's almost like if it was a pornographic movie, she shows up to like repair the boiler, right? and they wind up having sex. But
hey, the boiler's right here. I'll help you bend over to reach it.
Right, exactly.
So yeah. So,
but it's not what he set out to do that day.
No. And it's not even an opportunistic murder like some of his murders are. This is a murder of necessity, of somebody he has respect for and probably could have a liking for if she weren't on his tail.
Right.
You know, I do have a question about whether in fact she would have found out it was Hannibal, but I think even the chance that she might have is just too much of a chance for him.
Right. So the question I have about this whole thing, I was really puzzling over why there's so many movie references and why there's so many references to Silence of the Lambs, but also why this killing at the end is so different from the killing we see depicted at the beginning. Like,
the killings, even though that's not actually the Chesapeake Rippers who's done that killing, that is the style in which the Chesapeake Ripper kills, except the Chesapeake, who's Hannibal, but the Chesapeake Ripper does it worse, right? Like, the Chesapeake Ripper does it while the victims are alive. The Chesapeake Ripper wants them to feel pain, and the Chesapeake Ripper removes their organs for food. So it's even a worse murder than the murder we see at the beginning. Like, that what Hannibal actually does is worse.
Which is, although it doesn't happen on camera, this is something that, you know, I thought the minute I saw that murder reenacted through Will, with him punching that nurse in the face and seeming to take so much joy in her fear, the gouging out of the eyes, her crawling along the floor. It really has a giallo feel to it, that especially with her eyes poked out and her crawling along the floor. I've been sort of watching a lot of giallo movies lately. That really has a very giallo kind of vibe to it. And there's always like eyes getting poked out and people crawling while they're dying and leaving trails of blood and stuff. It really had that kind of feeling to me. But it's so sadistic. And we were talking last time a little bit about, or maybe a couple of discussions ago, about is Hannibal a sadist or not? And to me, this immediately struck me as, well, this is not the way Hannibal kills. He's not this brutal. He's not this sadistic. He doesn't take so much joy in others' pain. The point of him doing his killing is to exert some sort of dominance over the rest of the animal kingdom, that he's like a super predator and this is just what he does. The fact that you do find out that he really does kill people in a very sadistic way is surprising to me, because I really thought this episode, I really thought that there was a very strong contrast drawn between the brutality of the first killing and the way Hannibal goes about doing it. He's seen as cold, methodical, uninterested in creating panic or pain, whereas Gideon is brutal, sadistic, impulsive, and may not even take as much pleasure in doing this as much aesthetic pleasure. He's more violent as Hannibal. It is interesting to learn that Hannibal really does torture his victims and put them through a horrible ordeal, but that's not the way it's depicted here.
Does it make you love him less?
It actually, now this is weird because I'm so familiar with butchery. When you slaughter animals, you try to do as quickly as possible to not panic them, and mm-hmm. and your goal is to slaughter an animal so it doesn't even know what's happened, because when they panic, it releases adrenaline and it makes the meat taste bad and bitter and tough and all that. So I actually kind of thought it was inconsistent with Hannibal for him to do this, because if he does want to eat people, he shouldn't be torturing them and having them be in so much fear. But maybe that gets addressed. I don't know.
Yes, that's all interesting, because that's like why, you know, all the stuff about Temple Grandin and her designing of slaughterhouses is to make the death not frightening for them.
Right. They just round a corner and it's lights out.
Yes. And now I'm just thinking about how Temple Grandin was played in the movie by Claire Danes, who is Hugh Dancy's wife. So that's just nothing. do you, who I also saw on the street together in Tribeca.
Recently?
Like right when I first started watching Hannibal for the first time, I was going down the street and I saw a guy and I'm like, wow, that looks like a less handsome Hugh Dancy. And then I saw he was standing with Claire Danes, and it was in fact Hugh Dancy himself. Not less handsome, just how he looked. So do you want to talk, there's a bunch of stuff I'd like to talk about. Do you want to talk about the overall Silence of the Lamb references?
Yeah, let me see if I can kind of, without rambling too much, explain what I'm thinking about with it. I feel like what we're seeing here is, and I don't like to try to interpret what writers or filmmakers or directors are thinking or what's motivating them while they're doing something. It's impossible to picture the backstory, and it's impossible to know unless you talk to them yourself and really know what was going on. I do feel like there's a deliberate attempt in this episode, through the Silence of the Lambs references, to actually separate this series from the Silence of the Lambs. That, you know, I really felt like when you start watching it, I thought we were in Manhunter universe because of the kind of synthy music, the kind of coolness of the way things are shot, the fact that Hugh Dancy looks so much like his character does in Manhunter. So I always felt like we were more in Manhunter universe here. where this seems to be a deliberate attempt to say we are not, this is not your Silence of the Lambs as Hannibal Lecter.
This is not your mother's Silence of the Lambs.
This is not your mother's Hannibal Lecter. This is, right, because Hannibal Lecter is, even though Gideon is, he's dressed like him, he's posed like him, when you approach him in the institution, it's shot the same way. He's clever like Hannibal Lecter is in Silence of the Lambs. He's, you know, parries verbal. He is very verbally quick-witted and has like a wry sense of humor. He escapes from the handcuffs in almost the exact same way that Hannibal Lecter does in Silence of the Lambs with a small piece of metal, although mm-hmm. in this case he's got it shoved into his hand, which is really cool.
Yep.
And I think a bit of a callback to when Lecter pricks his finger with Jack's fish hook, but Will's fish hook. But so it's very much like mirroring a lot of stuff with Silence of the Lambs, but it's not about Hannibal Lecter. It's about this other guy. And in a way, it feels like a deliberate attempt to take all the Silence of the Lambs baggage and just offload it and say, okay, we're just going to purge all this right here. And we're going to use lines from Silence of the Lambs, and we're going to use framing, and we're going to use the same kind of tracking shots, and we're going to like keep hammering you over the head with it. But guess what? Our Hannibal is really so different from the Hannibal of Silence of the Lambs that he's much more like this other character who's inferior to our Hannibal than the Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs, right? So I do feel like that was sort of going on here. And again, I think sometimes it's just pointless to try to figure out what the filmmakers really had in mind when they were making choices. But I feel like really in this case, that does seem like a deliberate attempt or a deliberate statement to say, you want your Silence of the Lambs? Here it is, but it's not us. It's this other guy, right? What do you think?
I think I hadn't really come to a conclusion about why they wanted to put so much of that into this episode. That does make a lot of sense to me, although it's all done in a very loving and respectful, in some ways almost worshipful way.
Yes,
like, they
absolutely
are not saying this is crap and bullshit. They are saying, like, this is art that has to be respected.
Right, but I feel like in a way it's still a purge.
I think that makes a ton of sense to me why there's so much of it all in one episode, because it's just from start to finish. I mean, it's just from start to finish, and I think that take on it makes a lot of sense to me, that it was like, we all love Silence of the Lambs. We all want to, you know, see Silence of the Lambs. We associate Hannibal with Silence of the Lambs. Here's a lot of Silence of the Lambs stuff, but it's not Silence of the Lambs.
And it's not Manhunter either.
I wonder what would have happened if they'd ever gotten to Silence of the Lambs.
I know, because that was about to happen, right?
Yeah, and because they do get to Manhunter. I mean, I wish. That's a very, very interesting take, and I like it. I accept it. It's headcanon for me now.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
Can we go through some things that we may not get to all of this today, but I just wanted to go through some things that stuck out to me.
Sure.
Of course, when they're first going into the Baltimore State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, did you agree? It sounds like something out of like just a gothic novel, and looks like something out of a gothic novel.
It does, although all I can think about is High Anxiety in the institution for the very, very, very nervous.
So Will says when they arrive there that he's nervous going in because he's always afraid they won't let him out. And Jack says, I won't leave you. And Will says, today.
Right.
And that's, of course, some very heavy
foreshadowing yes.
of
yes,
what's going to
yes.
happen. I wanted to talk about how horrible Chilton is from the second. First of all, I think Raul Esparza as Chilton is phenomenal. Like,
yeah,
this is another, for me, another casting coup. I really know Raul Esparza as a Broadway musical actor. I haven't really researched how much television or movies he had done, but he is just, he's just really, really outstanding in this role. And yeah. So why is he so awful? First of all, he right away is a liar. He pretends not to know who Will is and then tries to like diminish Will by pretending to mistake him for a doctor. Yeah. And then say, oh, but you're also not an FBI agent. Like, he's just doing every disgusting, like, transparent power move.
Yep.
We know also he's lying about Will because he subsequently is like, oh, you're the talk of psychiatric circles with that thing you do. Like, yep. And then just sort of starts treating him like a freak. And like, oh, your neuroses and tics and you'd be a great study. And he could not be more horrible. He does this deliberate, like he delivers in the most inauthentic way. He sat right directly across from me at this table. And what does he say? He says,
oh, I feel responsible.
Sat directly across from me and I had no idea what he was hiding. By the way, he's looking at Will the whole time he's saying that. And I feel responsible for her death. He could not be more ecstatic about this. Because this is like his claim to fame, and Will is clearly disgusted by him. This is a sentiment Will really shares with Hannibal, to hate a person like this who is basically gauche and like grasping and aspiring and like a climber. Like Will is just kind of revolted by him.
Yep.
And also later he insults Alana. He says that her notes were more or less helpful. And then was like, more or less.
Yeah.
We talked already about the scene of Alana and Will each interviewing Dr. Gideon, which I just thought was seamless and really, really beautifully done. Okay, so can we talk for a second about Hannibal talking to Jack and the connection of Jack's grief over Bella to the loss of Miriam Lass? Like, this functions in the way therapy really functions.
Absolutely.
Like, first of all, Hannibal's actively listening. Like, Jack is expressing his feelings of grief about his wife, the imminent loss of his wife, and Hannibal responds to him, you're dreading the loss of your wife.
It's such a therapy move.
And
to just repeat what someone is saying back.
In a slightly different but completely substantively identical way.
Yes, and useful.
And then when Jack says it's making me think of other losses, Hannibal does what a good therapist would do, which is to intuit that this emotional state and this emotional situation resonates with a past experience
trauma.
Or past trauma, and either the therapist is intuiting it or the therapist, based on prior interaction with the patient, is aware of it. He's not going to say it himself. He pushes the client to be able to come to that conclusion on his own, except that Hannibal actually has outside knowledge of what this loss that Jack is connecting to is, because he's created it. I just think that's really interesting and fascinating.
But the amazing thing about Hannibal, the character, is he's able to separate that. It's almost as if the fact that he caused this is irrelevant, right? He can use it, and he's always calculating, but also in this case, it doesn't interfere with his therapeutic tone or the delivery or the help he's giving Jack right now.
100%.
At all, right?
100%.
He's not twitchy. He's not looking around. Like Chilton, when he's trying to put one over on people or when he's trying to like not reveal something, is so twitchy and inauthentic, and you just see what's going on. Hannibal, he puts it all aside and does his job.
Hannibal's doing the work, but also I think on some level getting pleasure from knowing what else that he's done this. Do you know what I mean? He's doing the work with Jack. And it's effective. Like, Jack is connecting this to Miriam Lass and his feelings of responsibility for Miriam Lass. And he does need to have this conversation. He does need to articulate this for his emotional well-being. And yep. Hannibal allows him to do that and guides him through it and assists him with it. And yet all the time, he's the person responsible for that trauma. And I think he gets a level of pleasure from knowing that he's responsible for that trauma. And that this has made Jack's grief over his wife just take on a deeper and richer grief.
Yeah. And I think I hadn't really thought about this, but somewhere under there also has to be Jack's fear that he's going to do the same thing to Will.
Oh,
and Hannibal's awareness of that.
100% agreed. And I think that's why there's an overt reference by Beverly making the connection between Miriam Lass and Will.
Oh, does that happen? I
it happens
don't
afterwards. It happens when they're going to find her arm. But I think it really does highlight why Jack has such a protective, even as he uses Will and doesn't. He uses Will just as he used Miriam Lass and sometimes manipulates Will in the way he manipulated Miriam Lass. But I think his experience with Miriam Lass has put him in a place where, although misguidedly, he is trying to put Will in the hands of Hannibal, a person who can look after Will's psyche. So he is not endangering Will's psyche in the way he endangered Miriam Lass's person.
I liked also, yes, and Jack is very consistent in his behavior here. I really like the way he's written and the way he interacts with Miriam when you first see him interacting with her. Something Jack is going to do is he's going to find a way to kind of push someone around and alpha dog them a little bit. But he's going to do different things depending on who the person is. So with Will, when he first interacts with Will, he grabs his glasses, he, you know, fixes his jacket or whatever that was he does. He intrudes in Will's space and
Correct.
Lets him know that sort of you belong to me. He does similar stuff with Miriam, but he does it verbally. He does it by, when she says, why do you want me to do this? And he says, well, you have all these qualifications. You have a PhD, you have a this, you have a that. But also, I just need a warm body.
Uh-huh.
You know, and
100%.
And then when he is getting ready to yep. have her do something yep. that he doesn't, how does he start? He starts by saying, get the fuck out of here.
Yep.
Your paper sucked.
Yep.
You know, your proposal's shitty. Go back to class, little girl.
Yep.
And then when he's got her sort of confused
and insecure.
And on the ropes.
Insecure.
He says, but listen, let's play it this way. And It's you know, it's not the, he wouldn't do that with Will, but he's very good at this. He's very good at manipulating people.
100%, I agree. He knocks her off her feet and then says, here's how you can earn back my admiration.
And it's what makes Chilton's transparency so galling. He's so bad at all this, and he's such a wannabe. He's a wannabe Hannibal in the way he dresses, right? He's dressing in expensive clothes that just with that weird double-breasted suit that just kind of looks a little weird on him. He even tries to go toe-to-toe with Hannibal about like food trivia, right?
Oh my
when
God.
He says, oh, they kill flamingos for
okay.
their tongues.
We
and
have
Hannibal's
to have
just like, shut up.
Okay. I want to come, I want to talk about that conversation. I really want to talk about that dinner a lot, mm-hmm. but I'm just going to point out, I have some notes here that Freddie Lenz's outfits are once again insane. She comes to the FBI in a crazy suit with a like see-through shirt with her bra showing under it. And her outfits are consistently nuts.
Yes, and then when she goes to see Gideon, she's
wearing
like this
skin-tight outfit with a leopard print sweater and gloves.
And gloves. Always the gloves.
And then she says, Dr. Gideon, may I call you Dr. Gideon? Or should I call you the Chesapeake Bay Ripper?
This episode I felt was, oop, I said it. I feel like I need to cattle prod myself every time I say the word episode. It's full of big entrances. Did you notice that? There's a lot of people sweeping into the room dramatically and showing up.
Uh-huh.
And she really shows up for that FBI meeting.
Uh-huh. And also, I will say she does quite a flex with the article she publishes, because it's all taking swipes at the FBI's incompetence and not having caught him. So, like, she's doing their bidding, but, like, they're not controlling her.
Not at all.
So, okay. So we talked about all of the series of manipulations that's gone on, and I just loved that cut from Jack actually manipulating Miriam to the really the voice with the word manipulation kicking in from Alana talking to Gideon before you even see her. I loved it. Okay, so the dinner with Chilton, Alana, and okay, so he says he is serving them tongue from a chatty lamb, and Chilton says, oh, the Romans used to kill flamingos to eat their tongues, and Hannibal says, don't give me ideas, your tongue is feisty, and then and that's when he says, it's good to have an old friend for dinner.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make a comment about the food, first of all. So, you know, Alana says she's never had tongue before.
Mm-hmm.
Tongue, to me, is one of those foods that if you haven't either been raised eating tongue, or if you're not a very adventurous eater, people are not eating tongue. And I will say that you and I were raised eating tongue. It was a ubiquitous meal in our household. To say it was as common as anything. A roast chicken or a hamburger or whatever.
A big boiled tongue.
And we both like tongue very much. And if tongue is on a menu, I will order it.
Absolutely.
When I find tongue on a menu, I will not hesitate. I always order it because I'm so excited to find it on a menu. That being said,
I eat duck tongue in Chinese restaurants. Like it is good.
Yes. That being said, the
lamb tongue's great.
The tongues on this plate looked.
They are just human tongues.
They're just fucking human tongues.
Wagging around.
They just looked weird. And I just cannot believe Alana's like, oh, I've never had tongue. Like, I, being a person who loves tongue, would definitely take a moment before I dived into that plate. I mean, as beautifully laid out as it is, it's crazy looking.
It's also tongues usually served. It's often
sliced.
Or
In a sauce, cubed in some kind of thing.
And it's very often it's lamb tongue, and it's, small, or duck tongues are a little small,
or like cow's tongue sliced thinly, like in a deli sandwich.
Yeah,
I mean,
never.
We did used to have a big giant cow tongue on a plate in our house.
I know. That's probably the least appetizing way to serve it. It still tastes good. But
delicious, but it was
it's
really
often in a stew. It can be stewed, so you don't even see what it is.
The Mexican has.
Yes, yep.
Okay.
There's tongue tacos, lingua tacos are delicious.
Delicious. So I wanted to just talk about the psychic driving, because this episode is so much about manipulation.
Yes.
And it's actually the first time they mention psychic driving. And
I got a PhD in the topic from the University of Googling for 2 minutes about it.
Oh, good. Okay, you want to just talk about that? And then we can talk about how it what I think about it.
Yes, I didn't go too deep in it because I didn't want it to color too much, like what I think it means here, because I just didn't even know, is that a real term or did they, I had no idea about the term. It is apparently a really, it's torture. It's a form of torture. It's used to force people to do things. And it is, from what I can tell, it's mostly referred to in the context of actually like torturing prisoners. So by repeating things to them over and over again, breaking them down, it is not nice behavior.
So, you know, Alana is sort of suggesting at the dinner that that might be what Chilton has done with Dr. Gideon. And he says, oh, that psychic driving is unethical. And Hannibal says, well, not if it was used to bring out what is repressed. that might be a reasonable use of psychic driving. Like Alana seems very shocked when he says there might be a reasonable use, and he says it to bring out something repressed. And I was just curious, is Hannibal, this is about what people's goals are, and I'm just wondering, like, Hannibal is driving Will, and everyone around him, but like he's driving Will in a very specific direction. He does this with Abigail. I don't know if it's what's traditionally meant as psychic driving, but he is driving behavior and driving thinking. And it just occurred to me, like, is Hannibal at this point, like, does he think there really is darkness or a murder in Will that he can bring out? Does he think that Will is such a pure empath that it's a challenge to corrupt him? Like, what is the reality of what Hannibal's goals are with Will at this moment?
Does he purely want a psychic drive him toward murder as a challenge and as like a way of triumphing? Or does he want Will to actually relish it and come to love it so that they can be connected? I mean, I think it's the latter. That's certainly where the show goes.
It certainly is. But I'm curious, like, Will has a fear that he has this capacity. That's a fear that's inside Will that Hannibal manipulates and capitalizes on. Does Hannibal believe that? Like, does Hannibal share Will's belief that Will has leanings in this direction? And you know what? I don't think this is a question we have to answer now, and maybe think about it, and we can talk about it more in the next episode and upcoming episodes. Because I think when we talk about this, we've been talking about this as he sort of sees this darkness in Will that he wants to bring out. He wants to manipulate this into coming out. And I'm just wondering how much of that is true now.
Mm. Well, that would go to potentially answer something I was asking you last time we talked about, why Hannibal is willing to let Will suffer this brain disease, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe Will right now to him is just kind of a goldfish, and he's just looking at him and is just curious about what's happening, and maybe he doesn't really decide that he wants to have this true bond and connection with him till later. That's a really good thing for us to watch for as things go by. Does the penny drop for Hannibal at some point that, like, I want to be with this person as opposed to just play with this person?
Yes. Mm. Like, is he right now just sort of, I mean, Will is obviously very challenging to him, but is he interesting to him? Like, he likes an interesting mind. Like,
yes.
And of course, like, he's smitten with Will because Will's mind is unique, truly unique. I don't know. I think it's something to keep thinking about. And I think it's something, maybe if people are listening to this, if they could let us know what they think, that would be good too. I have some other thoughts. Like I had said earlier, I wanted to talk kind of about what people's motivations are in this, but maybe we should wait till our rewatch and talk a little bit more about that then.
Sure.
Because we've been going like an hour now.
Oh, have we really?
Yes.
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah, I could go on forever about this episode. It's so good. Okay, good. Let's do that. Let's take a break now.
Oh, and I'm gonna leave you with one thing, which is Hannibal's tie in the flashback with Miriam Lass. I thought it was very, very special, and I thought of you when I was watching it because he's wearing an incredibly beautiful tie.
Yes, I noted it, and it looked like it's botanical, but it also looks like outer space a little bit, and I was trying to think of why that would be, what that wardrobe choice meant. So maybe we can mull that over when we're doing the rewatch.
And also mull over what the meaning is of his liking for grapes that have the same color on the outside as the inside.
Absolutely. And yes, there's a lot there.
Okay. Okay. So looking forward to it.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Yay. Hey, everyone. It's Matt jumping in for one more second. We're going to try something a little different this week. Our conversation went on for a really long time, so we're going to split this episode into two parts. And the second part, if you're listening to this on the Tuesday it comes out, the second part will be available Wednesday morning first thing. So we'll see you there.